Hello, everyone. Welcome back to episode 2 of the Early Clinical Learner series of Alert and Oriented. I'm Caroline Wang.
I'm Sam Shi. I'm a third-year medical student at Rush.
And it's Kevin Brzezinski.
He's back again, and we are so excited to kick off our next episode today with two M1 guests in front of us right now. So would you guys like to introduce yourselves?
Yeah, hi. My name is Kenny Pham. I'm a first-year medical student here at Rush. I'm from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I went to UPenn for undergrad, and as of right now, I'm interested in maybe trauma surgery or emergency medicine as specialties, but still open to changing.
I'm Naomi Bennett. Thank you so much for having us. I'm also an M1 from California. I'm really interested in neurosurgery as of now.
So excited to have you guys today. So the way that this episode is going to be laid out is similar to our previous episode. So first, we're going to have a case-based diagnosis. We're going to give 5 aliquots of information, and then you guys will make the final diagnosis, and we will validate that and show the evidence and all their hard work in getting to that final diagnosis. Then Kevin and Sam are going to lead through a teach back where they provide more clinical pearls and reflections on how this information and this style of like diagnostic development has been very helpful for them. And then finally, we'll have a Q&A section where we'll have reflections, tips and tricks, and how to better refine your clinical diagnostic reasoning. Does that sound good to you?
Yes.
Sounds great.
Awesome. So we're going to go ahead and dive into our case-based diagnosis. Our first aliquot of information is a general patient description. You have a patient coming in, and he's a 52-year-old male presenting with progressive dyspnea and intermittent dry cough. He says, "I've been feeling short of breath and coughing a lot for the past couple of months." His history of present illness is 52-year-old male, non-smoker, presents with progressive dyspnea over the last 3 months, and it's worse when he's exerted. There's a chronic timeline. There's an intermittent dry cough with no significant sputum production. There's some low-grade fevers, chills, and fatigue, but there's no weight loss or night sweats. And his symptoms worsen at home and seem slightly better when away for a few days. No history of asthma, COPD, no recent travel or sick contacts. So just off of this first general patient description, what are some things that are like popping into your head right now?
It sounds like there could be something going on with the lungs. I'm curious, as you said, it's better when he's away. Away from what?
When he's out of his environment, it's better.
And it sounds like there is a fever, so I would be worried about something infectious going on, since it also seems to be getting better when he's away from an environment that could have that agent in it.
I think the main takeaways for me were what he doesn't have. When we're taught the pulmonary system, you're instantly jumping to asthma or COPD or some kind of smoking-related issue. But from this current history, he doesn't have any of that. He's a non-smoker, no history of asthma or COPD. So I think that rules out a lot. And I think that's interesting for the going forward, what it could possibly be and what we could rule out from going forward.
We have a little bit more past medical history. And would there be any questions that jump to the top of your head when you hear about a patient presenting like this? What would you ask?
I guess I'm really curious about the environment. I've kind of latched onto that. Like, does he have mold in his house? Or what does he do for work even, if it's something he's related? And since he's not a smoker, I'm feeling not as much towards the emphysema route, but I know that it still is a possibility.
Right.
Yeah, and just to go off of that, I think top of my list is also environmental stuff and what he does for work, but secondary to that, maybe just ask about family history. Is there anything that runs in the family that we should know about?
Yeah, so
another thing that's just like popping off my head, or that I would like highlight or point out, is something I even feel like I learned clinically, but even got pointed out to me in like a first episode of Alert and Oriented as an M1, was thinking about your differentials based on like chronicity, like time. Mm-hmm. And so like, what are things in the lungs that are like acute versus mm-hmm. chronic? Even if you just think of it as binary as that,
yeah,
I think can help you like slight to focus in on just a few more things as opposed to everything going on.
Makes sense.
Yeah, I think you guys really hit the nail on the head. The next pieces of information we have with that general patient description is the past medical history is there's hypertension but no known lung disease. And then for social history, the patient is married, has 2 children, his partner and children are healthy, he's a healthy, active individual that lives on a farm, he works with hay, livestock, and poultry, and there's no tobacco, occasional alcohol use, and no known exposures to asbestos or silica. Is that leading you more towards a certain diagnosis?
I feel like the farmer is a buzzword that we've done in the past.
Yeah.
It sounds like he lives on this farm as well.
Okay, well, you guys have a great first start. We're going to jump into Aliquot 2, which is the physical exam and lung sounds. His vital signs, temperature is 99.2, heart rate is 92, blood pressure is 128 over 76, and 94% oxygen saturation on room air. His general appearance is no acute distress, but he appears fatigued. On his lung exam, you see bibasilar inspiratory crackles that are fine and Velcro-like. There's no wheezing, no signs of cyanosis or clubbing. If we move to the CBD exam, there's a normal S1, S2, there's no murmurs, and the extremities are, there's no peripheral edema, there's no clubbing appreciated. So just hearing that, what are your top differentials for progressive dyspnea with those inspiratory crackles?
Yeah, if I remember correctly, the term bibasilar Velcro refers more to some sort of interstitial lung disease, right? Because it goes through both lungs instead of it being lobular, like pneumonia, or TB, so we can rule out pneumonia, TB, which are also some of the other main lung conditions that we learned about. The no edema and like the no congestive heart failures or the heart conditions is good because we know obviously there's a lot of correlation with lung and cardiovascular health. Is there anything else you want to rule out?
Not that I can really think of other than what you've already said.
Is this helping kind of funnel down some diagnoses for you? It sounds like you're already eliminating quite a few and like you're really applying your knowledge right now.
I even like sometimes like just looking at, I think vitals are a big thing that you kind of like take for granted how important, they're not everything of course, but sometimes when you just take somebody's vitals into consideration, I can like start to picture like what that person looks like sitting in front of me. The guy doesn't really have a fever. He's a little bit tacky, he's breathing a lot, his blood pressure is like fine, his SpO2 is 94, which like isn't good, but he's not like 80%, 75%. So I even like taking vitals is like giving me just like an idea of like who's the person in front of me and how like sick are they or how like in distress are they, which I think it can also kind of give you a picture of like a disease process you could be thinking about too.
Gotcha. That totally makes sense.
Okay, so it sounds like we have made great progress, and now we're going to move on to Aliquot 3. We are really speeding through this, guys. You guys are doing amazing. This is labs and further clinical details. I guess one question I would like to ask is, let's say you put yourself in the shoes of the attending or the resident or the third-year med student on the wards right now, and this is the patient I see in front of you. What kind of labs are you interested in ordering?
And why?
And why?
If we're starting from the very basic, I would love to see if it's infectious through a WBC panel, just to see if there's something going on that's inflammatory. I would also be really interested in spirometry and PFTs to see if it's obstructive versus restrictive lung disease.
I would say the same. We already don't need the chest x-ray because you already said we got the bibasilar Velcro-like whatnot.
Do we still order a chest x-ray though?
Yeah, sure, why not?
I think we should still order a chest x-ray.
Yeah, worst comes to worst, it'll just be a repeat chest x-ray and we'll see if anything's changed.
Are there any other systems in the body? You guys are narrowed in on the lungs, which is like, I'm not trying to lead you astray. Are there any other systems or organs that you think could be important or worth ordering a test? Or you're telling your attending, I want this test because, or anything else to entertain? Working this person up.
I mean, just because it's always ordered, maybe like an EKG, but like the lack of like an S1, like normal S1, normal S2 kind of, I know, like I already said, we ruled out some sort of heart condition, but it doesn't hurt, I guess. I mean,
I agree. Now just to look at the heart, I think that's it for me as well.
I think you guys did a great job. You definitely are in the solid bucket of diagnoses. You're in that one organ system and you're ordering the labs that you think will correspond to that. For basic labs, you were right about the white blood cell count. We did get that. It's 8.5K. Hemoglobin is 14. Platelets are 250K. ESR is elevated and CRP is mildly elevated at 10 milligrams a liter. We also order liver and renal function tests and they come back normal. We do an arterial blood gas and the pH is 7.38. The oxygen is 60, carbon dioxide is 42, and FiO2 is 21%. There's mild hypoxemia and normal CO2. There's also pulmonary function tests. There is a restrictive pattern, which is lowered FVC, and then a higher FEV1 to FVC ratio, a lower TLC, and a lower RV. You also see decreased diffusion capacity, or DLCO. So is this further cementing what you think might be the final diagnosis, or what else are you thinking about right now?
Why don't you guys, by category, summarize, you know, synthesize what we have. So we have some basic labs, white blood cell count, hemoglobin, platelets. We have some inflammatory markers, liver, kidney tests. Then there's a blood gas, and then there's PFT. So why don't you go by category and kind of summarize, and while doing that, synthesize where this is pointing us.
So from the white blood cell count on itself, we know that it's elevated, right? So there's some kind of infection going on. The main thing I took away from the blood gas is that he's obviously acidotic. I guess we can't really say that. It's like, it's not acidotic, but...
I was going to say the ABG, to me, looks okay.
Yeah.
It doesn't look too acidotic or alkalotic. It is interesting that he's in a restrictive pattern. I think that supports what we've been talking about. The DLCO being decreased also supports what we've been talking about. The WBC being increased supports that inflammation response we were talking about.
I'll circle back. It's our fault for not really giving reference values, but the white blood cell counts within the normal range. So normal
is
4 to 10. Above 10 is elevated. And then I'd caution you guys to call something infectious on a white blood cell count. It can clue into infection, but it's a really good marker of inflammation. So think of it more broadly. If it's ever elevated, yes, you should think about infection, but shouldn't just say it's infection, because it could just be something inflammatory.
Gotcha.
Hemoglobin platelets are normal. The inflammatory markers are mildly elevated, but not crazy.
Okay.
The arterial blood gas, it's on the acidotic end of things, but it's not acidotic. So you really don't start to think of that until less than 7.35, and then this is also evidenced by a normal PCO2 in this individual, so PCO2 42. I think the big takeaway is the PaO2 is lower than we should see in someone like this.
Okay.
So it's 60, which correlates to about an SpO2 of 90-ish. So he's hypoxemic, and then you guys have nailed it with the restrictive pattern on the PFTs.
Okay. Yeah. So what imaging would you say would be the most helpful next for you?
I think the chest x-ray to see if there's anything that could show us more definitively of what we've been suspecting.
I forget. For these kinds of... Is it valuable at all to x-ray the airways as well, like the trachea and whatnot, to see if there's any dilation or constriction? My main goal is the chest x-ray, but I'm thinking like...
A normal portable chest x-ray or a PA or AP will catch trachea structure, so you'll be able to see if it's patent or not from just a chest x-ray, but I think you're getting a cross-sectional imaging, which would be a CT scan.
Okay, gotcha.
So yes, we order a chest x-ray, we order a high-resolution CT scan, and on the chest x-ray...
If you guys, before Caroline even tells you what's on the chest x-ray,
yeah.
This is, like, I think a fun practice that they have us... I did, like, every rotation where we had imaging, just, like, there's kind of, like, a systematic way that they teach us to read imaging, as well as, I think, like, the more images you see, the more you have an idea of kind of, I guess, like, what's normal, what's not normal, and what's kind of standing out to you. So do you guys know of a way that you can, like, systematically read a chest x-ray, or even just if you want to take a stab at, like, does something jump out to you as, like, crazy abnormal or not abnormal?
Sure. So I think we've been taught the ABC D's, and so A is airway. From where I'm sitting, it looks okay. I do see this large black, slightly more black mass over on the left side of the patient. I'm not sure if that points to the B and ABCs or not.
I'm not sure either.
Or like A, I think it's like the what you guys are talking about. A, airways. Is the patient breathing well enough? When you do the chest x-ray, you can count how many ribs you see to see if their lungs are entirely expanded. Just to get an idea if it's a good image.
Okay. Yeah, it looks like B is okay then, because it is, like Kenny was saying, the costovertebral angle is still pretty sharp. See all the ribs.
Yeah, you see, like, I think, like, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8-ish,
which is pretty good, too. And then this...
Is it the costovertebral angle?
Or I even think, what does the heart look like, too?
Oh, right.
Yeah. How does the heart... What do you think? What does the size look like to you?
The size looks normal to us, which is in congruence with what we were saying about it's probably not a heart-related issue good to rule out with these kinds of lung issues.
And then, like, the diaphragmatic angle, which is what you guys were getting at. And then you don't see, like, any air under the diaphragm, and you see the angles are sharp. And then, like, E is, like, everything else. Just, is there anything that, like, jumps out to you as, like, weird?
I would say on the left side, I think that there's, like, extra blackness there that looks a little bit interesting to me. And then it also looks like I'm not sure if there's like a little bit of whiteness on each side, and I'm not sure if that would represent like the alveolar haze that we've talked about before.
Referencing the stuff right here in the center?
Yeah.
So you're comparing, big picture, left and right, it has more black versus right, which looks a little bit more gray.
Yes.
What is it on x-ray when something is black versus gray or white?
Black would be air versus white is more blood or fluid.
I don't even have enough experience with text x-rays. I see this kind of perihilar, cloudy white. I don't actually know if this is normal or abnormal, but I see this. Okay. I agree with you here. It's something, but I don't know if it's normal or abnormal.
So synthesizing everything you just saw, what is your takeaway from the chest x-ray?
If you ordered this, would this jump out to you as something super concerning? Does it support or not support? Would this merit you getting more imaging? If this came to you, would you say, I have to tell someone about this? Or this changes everything, or would you need more? Even if you kind of just think about it like that.
I would say we need more.
Yeah.
It's not really jumping out as an emergent scary thing.
Would an emergent scary thing be on a chest x-ray?
I guess like a pneumothorax, hemothorax.
That's
I'm also not seeing, I guess I think about like TB, maybe you would see cavitary lesions. I'm not seeing anything like that. It supports this idea of the chronic process where this patient is not super like bad off, but he's also clearly going through something.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We were also taught in reference to the heart that if one side of the heart is obscured by the lungs, whether that's some issues like the superior versus inferior lobe of either lung, I guess, so that would be a big problem. Like Naomi said, pneumothorax, and along the same lines, like a hemothorax, where there's more like penetrating fluid injury to the lung itself. And obviously, we already ruled out like cardiac a while ago, but maybe you can also see like a very obvious like cardiac like dilation or something if there's like really bad like lung issues.
Yeah,
but.
And like I think it's like cool when like all your stuff is supporting like the chest x-ray imaging and how you guys read it supports like the person you see in front of you too.
Yeah.
And all the labs you got, you walked through all the values and some things are close but not there's some inflammation but not something really crazy. Your labs, chest x-ray, and the person sitting in front of you are all corroborating a story.
Makes sense.
You guys did a great job. From the x-ray, we see mild reticular nodular opacities that are more prominent. Taking a look, where would you say they're more prominent?
It's pretty diffuse, right? The main thing, like I said earlier, is that's not lobule, which is a very big deal.
So it's more prominent in the upper mid lung zones, not lobular or anything, which would definitely set you in a slightly different direction. So next, we're going to go over the high resolution CT.
We'll
do the same thing. This is the last one that we ask you to do.
Again, take it as we did the last one. Like, just if you saw this, and I'm a very experienced at reading x-rays, but especially in terms of, like, high-res CTs, but is something, like, jumping out to you, maybe the first question is, anything jumping out to you is, like, normal, abnormal, and then maybe what's also helpful is, like, orienting yourself to recognizable structures in an image, so you have an idea. Like, what is... For listeners, I'm like referencing this like whitish area right in the middle. So like actually, like what are these on either side?
The lungs.
Yeah. So then like what is this big structure right in the center?
The heart.
Yeah.
It's your heart. And then like what are these two big black like openings that are kind of behind, they are posterior to your heart and they're also like black.
The
trachea, esophagus.
No, the bronchi, because you see the two folds, that's after the bifurcation of the trachea.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I'm trying to remember, like, where, I don't think you necessarily, the esophagus would be, most of the time, unless there's food coming through it, it'd be closed, they're smushed together.
Is it the white hole in front of
the spine?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, so it's also nice with imaging to orient yourself to what's what.
Yeah.
Even if someone's asking kind of that, because I think every time, so you kind of have oriented yourself. What like looks abnormal or normal to you? Or is there anything that jumps out?
Visibly, there's a lot more white lines running diffusely through the lungs, which we know shouldn't be there, but they're like big segments of white, like what looks like scarring or fibrosing just like throughout. And so we know, like Naomi said earlier, it's not an emergent issue, but something that we should take a further look at and see what the root cause is.
I can confirm that you do see some kind of thickening of the alveolar septa. As Sam mentioned, this is an axial plane. You guys are doing great in like identifying everything. And I'm super impressed with, like, you were able to identify everything on that chest CT, like, just straight out. And that's really impressive. So were there any patterns that you saw, like, that maybe, like, threw any words in your mind just looking at this?
I guess diffuse, again, it's mm-hmm. everywhere.
Right.
Diffuse fibrosis, a word we've seen a lot.
I think you said Velcro earlier, I believe. That's usually something that is used to describe fibrosing in lungs.
It looks like high-res of lung parenchyma and tissue. The texture of whatever is happening here looks different than what's happening on the edge over here.
Right.
And I don't even know what the... I don't... Like, even off the dome, someone asked me, I don't know, like, a word, but if I was reading this, I'd be like, oh, like, it looks like there's a difference in texture of the lung parenchyma in different spots. So, like, what's normal, what's abnormal? I'm not entirely sure, but I know that it's different. And this person has a disease process. This looks different than that.
Makes sense.
How would you describe an area over here, maybe, versus this area over here?
Honeycomb?
Yeah, just being like, oh, yeah, I'm looking at this, and the texture looks different in different spots of the lungs, too.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty diffusive, if you guys are saying.
And would you note that the patient left lung is more on the outside, whereas the patient right lung is kind of diffuse throughout?
Comparing and contrasting the two sides is good. And then you can corroborate that with your physical exam, if it sounds different.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So you guys have identified so much. From what we get back from this lab and from all these labs in high-resolution chest CT, there is honeycombing, ground glass opacities with inspiratory mosaic attenuation. There's a pattern typical of fibrotic HP that shows a random axial distribution, and there's coarse reticulation, small airway disease with some honeycombing, as we mentioned. Okay, so now we are on to the final aliquot, final details. You guys look very confident in your final diagnosis, so I'm feeling super excited for you. Is there anything else that, with whatever diagnosis you have in mind, you would want to get to cement that this is it?
I guess this isn't related to an exam, but more so to social history. Like, like, how long has this person been living / working on this farm, right? Because Naomi and I are pretty much in agreement with a diagnosis already, but it feels odd to me that it came out so suddenly, even though this person has been living there for a while. And I still want to see, if we're trying to address the root cause of this issue, how can we help this patient with their environment to maybe reduce their symptoms going forward?
Mm-hmm.
Because that seems like the best treatment, even after we give the medication we would want to give, I guess.
Or you guys have ordered labs, which then justified your imaging. Your history justified all these tests. Do you think that, like, your labs, your imaging, your history justifies you getting any, like, pathology on the person? Would you want one more invasive test, or how would that change your management or diagnosis?
I think if we just wanted to rule everything possible, we could do a lung biopsy just in case. But like you said, it is very invasive, so I would understand if a normal hospital wouldn't want to risk the patient's health further if they have a confirmatory diagnosis.
Right.
Then again, I also just don't know realistically what lengths the hospital would go to if they already more or less know a diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm going to jump quickly back to your first question, which was about social history or HPI. And I think that's a really great point, because Dr. Abrams was talking to us about when you see a patient and they're presenting to you, it's like sick or not sick. And then from there, going by a systems approach and everything is interconnected, how important it is to clue that into your final diagnoses and your understanding of medicine as a whole. But I think you guys are on a great track. So back to HPI. We did mention that he is a 52-year-old male. He's a non-smoker, and it was a progressive dyspnea, but you're right. It was only over the last 3 months, and it was worse with exertion. It is like a chronic timeline because it's very progressive, and that's the picture the first aliquot is trying to portray. There wasn't exactly like a timeline of how long the patient was working on the farm, but that's just something that's noted in their social history. Back to the final details. You guys were great. You ordered the right thing. We get a lung biopsy done, and you see poorly formed granulomas with peribronchiolar inflammation and no evidence of bridging fibrosis. We can also do another panel, and one panel might be able to do is a hypersensitivity panel. And so what do you think you would want to see on that panel? Like IgG or IgM or...
IgE.
Yeah. I think IgE is more so like an allergic reaction.
Okay.
So I think some sort of hypersensitivity panel, maybe we would see more like IgM or G.
Well, if it's chronic, it's G, right?
Yeah.
IgG.
It's great that you brought up that first point about like chronic timelines, because we do see those IgG antibodies to mold and specifically to bird proteins.
Okay.
And then finally, we also see a bronchoalveolar lavage with alveolar lymphocytosis, and you see elevated lymphocytes that are greater than 30%. So those are your final details. You guys sped through this because you were excellent at pinning down the right systems, and it sounds like you were very confident. So what do you think, putting together all this information, could be your final diagnosis?
I'm suspecting hypersensitivity pneumonitis.
Yeah, and what do you think?
I would agree, but I think, could there be some like comorbid like ARDS maybe that results from some sort of alveolar destruction? I'm less inclined to say that because, like you said, it's chronic and not acute, but I can't imagine so much lymphocyte infiltration in the alveoli would not eventually destroy some of the alveolar wall and then thus rupture. But
I see.
Obviously the main differential is the hypersensitivity pneumonitis.
Yeah, you guys are correct. It's a non- Getty is not on the side of the table. And you had no reason to worry because you guys, I think from the first aliquot, you guys already kind
of
had...
I heard the farmer. I was like, okay.
Right. And you have the sketchy in your head and there's a farm in the background. So yeah, the diagnosis is non-fibrotic hypersensitivity pneumonitis, and the subtype is farmer's lung disease. So the farmer is really a key point here. It's likely caused by repeated exposure to moldy hay. Kenny, you brought up a great point and a great question about like ARDS secondary. And so, Kevin, what's your take on
I would not think of them in the same bucket here. So ARDS is non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema is how I would think about it as the predominant finding. It's in a rapid acute deterioration, which is not the clinical picture here. And then two, the radiographic findings don't support it. Basically, it'd be like bilateral predominant ground class opacities or seeing more of a fine reticular pattern. One, time course is the most important in that, and then two is kind of radiographic features to support it. I would not think of them in the same bucket here. You can get ARDS like physiology with acute exacerbations of interstitial lung disease, but often those are separate too.
Could ARDS ever be a sequela to these kinds of conditions, or is it more so a completely different etiology?
Usually separate. Okay. The things that can mimic it are acute exacerbations of these, but especially in hypersensitivity pneumonitis, it's very unlikely to see that with this process.
But you guys did an amazing job with the case diagnosis. Now we're going to move into the feedback portion, where I'm going to let Kevin and Sam take over and, you know, teach you all these clinical pearls about hypersensitivity pneumonitis and pulmonary diseases in general.
Yeah, so I think I'll kick things off. I think you guys were keenly on the right track from the beginning. And I like to think of this, which I think you guys did, in identifying this is an interstitial lung disease. It's really a group of interstitial lung diseases. And finding clinical features that support that diagnosis is what the first aliquots provided you guys with. This patient had progressive dyspnea and dry cough. Those are two pulmonary symptoms that these patients with HP have, and it's often on a chronic timeline, often many weeks to months. That's an important differentiator from things like infection and other disease processes, because a lot of things, infection particularly, not indolent infections, are flip of the switch kind of symptoms, right? So this was a slow build, slow burn. The other thing that we did talk about in the beginning was symptoms worse at home, right? So this is an exposure disease. So patient felt better when he was not at home. That clued you guys in that this is some exposure-related lung disease, which HP is. Other clinical features were low-grade fever and fatigue, which are nonspecific but clue into some systemic inflammatory process, which this is. It's an immunologic reaction to something that the body doesn't like. Next were the physical exam findings. Kenny seemed to focus on this, the bilateral inspiratory crackles, the buzzword being Velcro-like. And it, honestly, I have a specific interest in interstitial lung diseases. When you listen to folks with interstitial lung disease, I understand why that is a buzzword, because it really does sound like Velcro. When you hear that for the first time, you'll understand what I'm saying. That's very classic of interstitial lung disease. Another pertinent negative here was no clubbing. Clubbing can be a finding associated with chronic hypoxemia and very advanced stage of certain lung diseases, so it is a pertinent negative here. And then, before I hand things off to Sam to talk, the pulmonary function tests are restrictive patterns, so the two big patterns are restrictive or obstructive. Obstructive, very classically in tobacco-related lung disease. Restrictive can include many different lung diseases, but one that we are interested in this case is interstitial lung disease. The classic hallmarks of restrictive pattern are decreased FVC, decreased FEV1, but the combination of those two preserves the ratio. Whereas in obstructive disease, it's the ratio that is abnormal primarily. Total lung capacity being down and residual volume being down confirms it being a restrictive pattern based on the first three. Next, the diffusion capacity. So that's basically a measure of how carbon monoxide moves across the alveolar membrane into the blood. When you get interstitial lung disease, it's a inflammatory fibrotic process of those thin membranes. So if those are inflamed, they're becoming larger and the diffusion across them decreases. So what we see is a drop in the DLCO. So things are not diffusing across the membrane at the level that they should be. And that's where you start to see hypoxemia develop in these patients. And then last, which really clues you into HP as a diagnosis in this case, is high-res CT findings, which we'll talk about in a second, but the big one being, we'll save it, but air trapping is a big thing about hypersensitivity pneumonitis. You can see it on PFTs. It's a very specific measure. We don't need to talk about it here, but it's basically FEF, FBC, FEF 25-75%. We don't need to talk about it. We'll talk about it in the imaging section more.
More things that we can point out or highlight as learning points from the case. When you guys ordered labs, you saw there was an elevated ESR in CRP, which points to like mild systemic inflammation, and again supports like this like inflammatory process that can be seen in HP, as well as positive IgG antibodies. And then presumably the exposure that the person had, like mold or animal proteins or whatever is there. Imaging, which I think Kevin will be even better at talking about, this high-res CT.
Do you guys know what that is?
I only know what a CT is.
Great.
I mean, I'm assuming, say, I know the same, but I'm just assuming high-res just like, I don't know, like you can see like more into the
right?
organs.
It is true. The slice thickness is 1 millimeter slices on a high-res. But what really differentiates this test and being something that pulmonologists really love is it involves maneuvers. It involves inspiratory and expiratory capture. So they'll ask a patient to take a big deep breath and hold it. They'll ask a patient to exhale completely and hold that and then take images, which we'll talk about in a second. And then there's prone imaging. So basically they're lying on their chest and then we're getting imaging, and that's helpful in cases where ground glass opacities are a prominent finding in a lot of lung disease. And that isn't all that helpful because it means something like you guys have hinted at, it's blood, pus, water, protein, or blood. Sorry, I said blood twice. Prone imaging is very helpful in that if anything is gravity dependent, it will resolve on the posterior lung fields with proning. So if you don't see resolution of those findings, then you can feel pretty good that it's not a gravity dependent process. That's why we get that. They might look a little prettier because the slice thickness is different, but it's really about the maneuvers that are done that help differentiate certain processes that pulmonologists love.
That's cool. I did not know that at all. I feel like Kevin actually highlighted a lot from the imaging. Another thing we could talk about would be the bronchoalveolar lavage and the PATH also confirmed the disease process. We saw increased lymphocytes, which is a specific but non-sensitive feature of HP. And then biopsy, if we decided to perform it, we saw these granulomas and peribronchial inflammation. And the granulomas, as you guys learned in PATH, is just like a gathering, kind of like it's like a sectioning off of an inflammatory process.
Real life presentation of this follows very closely to how this played out. It is so rare that we pursue biopsy in this case because of how great our imaging techniques are now. This case is pretty slam dunk from a radiographic pattern to support hypersensitivity pneumonitis. And now we do have panel immunoglobulin testing to support it further. Although it's not all comprehensive, so you're going to still have HP with negative HP panels just because it doesn't include everything. It really becomes a radiographic pattern that supports it. And the diagnosis is confirmed at a multidisciplinary discussion. That's a combination of expert pulmonologists in interstitial lung disease, thoracic radiologists, and if needed, pathologists or rheumatologists, depending. Basically, I'll sit down a certain day of the week, talk about difficult cases, and say, yes, we all agree this is interstitial lung disease. Yes, we all agree this is hypersensitivity pneumonitis. Then we say a diagnosis is confirmed.
For next steps in management of care, I think you already kind of like walked us through, and I think it's so nice that even as M1s, we're starting to think about, is this needed? And like, you know, how intentional do we want to be with our labs and like imaging and all that? And so for next steps, Sam, what do you think have you picked up from the wards and your clinical pearls?
Yeah, before thinking next steps, both the point Kevin made about imaging being so good, and I feel like people have said this to me when I've been trying to present assessment and plans to attendings in different spaces. If you order a test, you have to like know that the results of the test are going to change your management. Like, why do I care if it's not going to change my management? And like, if you get this result and it's abnormal, then it's like you have to follow why it's abnormal and be able to explain or account for why it's abnormal. So when I even asked you guys, like, oh, do you want biopsy? Like, would it change your management? I think that's what everyone always asks me. If you got this, like, why do I care? Why would I do that? Until you were there, I didn't even know that about the high-resolution CT, like, what I've actually done, or, like, lung maneuvers. I feel like until you watch, like, I've done, I think it was with, like, anesthesia or something, I watched them do lung biopsies, and, like, he was doing bronchoscopy, and, like, having me actually be using, like, the needle and, like, pushing it through and, like, grabbing it, and it's like bloody and it's like pokey and you're ripping it out every single time. The person's under anesthesia and intubated, whatever. So I think it also gives you like, I feel like more of like a gut intuition feel of like how invasive a test is or whether or not it's worth it and why you want it. But next steps could be like avoidance of your antigen exposure in your patient. So like limiting contact with what is causing them to have HP. That's hard when that's their profession, the patient's profession, like a farmer. So you could also do a prolonged course of steroids followed by a taper. Steroid-sparing agents like mycophenolate, azathioprine, and rituximab. I don't have a lot of experience on steroid tapers and stuff. I feel like anecdotally from everywhere in the hospital, steroids are used super liberally in many different contexts, and almost like steroid is an answer to a lot of things because it tapers down your inflammation. But like at the same time, I feel like people are very, like, I don't actually have the answer, but people are thoughtful about how they use steroids and the tapering of them, because there can be issues if you take them off quickly, like kidney issues and stuff like that.
Yeah, we don't need to get into it in the purpose of this, but yeah, steroids have a lot of side effects, so we caution using them if we don't need to. In cases like these for HP, it is often a prolonged taper for most, on the order of months, where you're gradually decreasing the dose. If patients respond well to that, you consider steroid-sparing agents, which are basically immunosuppression. So mycophenolate, azathioprine, and rituximab being one of the most extreme on that spectrum. But that's not the case for everyone. The hallmark of therapy in HP is avoiding the antigen.
Yeah, so then now this is kind of going into teaching, and I'm going to take my best stab at the disclaimer. I am not a pulmonologist. And every time that I've tried to force myself to learn this for the sake of standardized tests, I fall short. So I was trying to force myself to learn how to like look back at this and like learn how to think about PFTs as well as like these flow volume loops and obstructive versus restrictive lung diseases. So we've talked about how like pulmonary function testing, as I understand it, is like something that like helps, again, like it's not going to be the thing that you like hang your hat on diagnostically, but it can like help support like for or against and help you understand like whether it's obstructive or restrictive. For listeners, I'm looking at like flow volume loops in obstructive versus restrictive. So you guys see these in class a lot.
Yeah.
How are they taught to you in class? Or how do you guys understand them, at least like as M1s? Or how did like...
We're just taught the shapes, like what things should look like for restrictive versus obstructive.
There's some characteristic shapes of certain diseases like asthma where the expiratory has that slope to it. And then obviously where that shape is vertically and along the x-axis tells you whether it's obstructive or restrictive. That tells you a lot about volume. Yeah, and I'm sure you're going to get into that. So.
I'll try my best, but I also generally understand these by looking at the shapes and how I can look at the shapes of these graphs and help like it support kind of my understanding of the disease processes. This is a boiled down image from first aid. On the left, it's showing normal, and it gives you this idea of like shape, and all these numbers are kind of corresponding to like flow and to volume in the lung. But like, at least for the basic understanding of obstructive versus restrictive, obstructive is something that is blocking. You get volume trapping or air trapping with obstructive diseases like asthma, which then kind of like the pink puffer kind of thing.
Right.
Obstructive shifts your loop to the left. If volume is here on the left, the green loop actually like is going to like, you're having like air trapping, which is almost showing like a larger volume. And then this restrictive process we've talked about, the shape of it has stayed the same, but the volume in the lungs that's able to be expanded has decreased. So I don't know. I wish I had more to add in my understanding, but at least for the purposes of this, I think it's on the level of my learning or understanding, or maybe even your guys' understanding the shapes which you've already talked about, but also trying to, like, the best you can, like, think about how, like, measurements changing and shape kind of, like, correspond to what the disease process is.
Yeah.
And like you said, with asthma, you can have air trapping, so you get the balloon. I also think it's interesting that, like, vertically, it makes sense since the bottleneck is tighter, and you have less flow out, which is why the y-axis is decreased. But that doesn't make sense for restrictive, because the airway is still normal in theory. So the output is more or less the same, but in respect to the actual diminished lung capacity.
That was a really great teach back. It was very comprehensive, and I learned a lot, especially about things like high resolution CT. As a final summary, before we jump into the Q&A and reflections, the patient's history, like the occupational exposure that we talked about, that symptom pattern where it's worse at home and it's better when he's away, the imaging, the PFTs, BAL findings, and finally the positive IgG panel all point towards this subacute hypersensitivity pneumonitis. Next steps would be avoiding the inciting antigen and possibly using steroids for symptom relief. So that was a very, like, long but really fun and, like, lots of twists and turns, I think, in terms of, like, teach back and, like, the questions we asked you. What were some of the challenges that you faced in this episode trying to put everything together into one final diagnosis?
We obviously were taught how to read the chest x-rays and T scans, but I think I would speak for the both of us that we're not experts in it. I feel like that's one of my tougher aspects of medicine, is just recognizing diagnoses from images, because we don't have to apply it that often. We're not relying on that as a sole measure usually. Yeah, that just comes with exposure, I think.
For sure, yeah.
Similarly, I didn't know that some of these labs even existed. Like, I've never heard of a hypersensitivity panel, so I didn't even know that that was something we could have tested for.
Right. Given the limited 6-7 months of knowledge we have,
yeah.
You guys did a really solid job. What did you feel was most helpful in choosing your final diagnosis?
Can I quickly talk back to the imaging thing too?
Yeah.
Because, right, like, you're getting exposed to it, you're learning your disease processes, and they're kind of giving you this framework to read things. I find it really helpful, like, even now, just being able to, like, A, orient yourself, get a well-informed, like, vibe of what's happening in imaging, as well as being able to, like, maybe you don't have the language that a radiologist would have to describe something. You can even compare, like, right and left, or, like, this looks weird, or, like, these two things are different, or, like, some, and the more you do that, the more you can catch if something's off. Like, how many, I, like, did this a lot, like, in medicine, a lot of, like, the ICU rotations that I was on, was just, like, there, they'll give you a lot of time to, like, look through images, and, like, it's tempting because someone, if, like, the image is read, they'll have a reading of it, and you can kind of read it, but even, like, taking the radiologist reading and seeing if you can see what they're writing down can be a good way of teaching yourself. Once I was on my surgery rotation, and a read came back for some kind of, like, abdominal x-ray, and she's like, why aren't they reading this fast enough? Why aren't they reading this fast enough? She's like, we're going to imaging, and she took us, all of us, down. Like, we went into that dark room where they all sit in front of their computers. She starts talking through, like, the disease process with the person reading it. So she was even able to be, like, she presented her HPI to the person reading the image. So it would surprise you how you get better at it as you go. Unless you're a radiologist, you don't have to be perfect at it, but, yeah, sorry.
I think that was a good decision, and we're all learning so much about this, and I think this will be really helpful when we eventually do go on to rotations as well. So what did you feel was most helpful in helping you choose your final diagnosis?
Speaking for myself, I think the farmer. And hearing that it was better when he was away from his farm at home.
And still saying in the broad category, but a little more narrow, having the, like, PFTs of, and, like, narrowing it down to restrictive definitely, like, canceled out a lot, I feel like, for us.
Right. So mainly the occupation and the history and the social history, plus maybe some of the lab findings, really solidified it for you guys.
Yes.
And one last question. In the future, as you are continuing to apply your knowledge into different clinical cases, what are some advice or strategies that you might be taking away from this experience to further build on in the future? Does that make sense? Like, what did you find from this experience that you think might be helpful in terms of clinical diagnosis later?
I found it so helpful how you took us through where we didn't need to know exactly what was happening on the x-ray or the CT, but it was sort of like, does this support your finding that this is chronic and that it's not emergent and that it's okay? Like, it supports the physical exam that we saw.
I think I like the structure of the podcast in the sense of it's like clue one, clue two, blah, 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 to clue five. I think whenever you get your Epic access for the first time and you see all the tabs at once, you're kind of at a loss, like, which one is most important? Which one do I look first? Is it the notes? Is it the vitals? And so I think just thinking of, like, taking it step by step, going, like, broad to narrow to help your diagnosis definitely helps you not only get a better picture of what the diagnosis could be and narrow your differential, but also not get overwhelmed as much because there's an infinite number of things you could research, pathologies you could look into. But at the end of the day, if you have some sort of template to narrow down your differential, that'll help a lot.
Right.
Yeah. Like, I find more and more people are like, you can really get close to your diagnosis with a really good HPI. Getting your story and even the good physical exam can get you really close. I find the meat of your diagnosis is story. When I started, you think like labs and imaging are the most important thing because they're like shiny and sexy, or they like kind of like, it's data. This is really going to support it. But I think the more gray you get into are the cases that are like less like slam dunky. It's like the data's can help you support something, but it's only coming from your clinical reasoning that you can use the data to support what you think.
Right.
At least that's what I've seen.
I personally also really love the way it's laid out, like from aliquot 1 to 5, with aliquot 1 being the major meat of it. Coming into med school, I would always hear about cognitive biases and like social determinants of health, which are all really important, but I always was like, I really want to make sure I've become the kind of doctor that doesn't let that bias push me in one direction, and you know, I'm like blinded to other possibilities of diagnoses. So thinking in this way, where you keep it very open at first and you separate everything into different buckets or organ systems and think about it like interconnected, has been really, really great in that way. Yeah. I think that is the end of our episode. Thank you so much for being our guest. You guys did an amazing job. This is like a slam dunk of an episode. And Kevin and Sam, thank you so much for being our amazing TeachBack leads, co-host today. We cannot wait to see you guys in the next episode.
Thank you so much.